So if you will take a seat, there's somebody has lost their glasses in the grounds, their spectacles. And so so if you find them, could you take them to the office, the lost and found there? And they're in a blue case, brown edged glasses. So if you happen to step on them. And if you take them to the office here, or bring that to a monk or nun, then we'll put them in the lot. She left her name here, so we can contact her if they're found. It's a crisis when you lose your glasses. Yeah, one time when I talk about mindfulness, I couldn't find my glasses anywhere. Looked everywhere and I found they were on my nose. So remember, whatever, you know, no matter how, what you're doing in life, no matter what you say, you have to usually, at moments, eat your own words. Usually when I talk about mindfulness and I do something very mindless. The other morning, breakfast, I spilled marmalade on my robe. So are there any questions? The things you want me to expand on? Yes?
You talked about the bad habits we have and how we react in some situations in emotional ways or getting stressed and so on. And were you saying that it's rather than trying to change these bad habits, it's enough to observe these things, the reactions we have, or?
Well, what I've found is, you know, because I have a critical mind, and then I know I have bad habits, and then I try to get rid of them through a willful, you know, through saying they're bad, and I try to change them. Sometimes I can, you know, get some result, good result from it, but it doesn't really resolve the problem because there's oftentimes a lot of willfulness and suppression and ignorance still involved, even in it. So this is where learning to trust yourself to get not the idea of getting rid of the habit, but of understanding, seeing it, recognizing it, and then from there you once you recognize, you have that perspective, then you can decide whether you want to perpetuate it or not. But if you're just judging, reacting, you know, like you say something or you do something that's not very skillful, and then you start saying, oh, I'm terrible for doing that, and then you start disparaging yourself, you tend to create a habit of self-disparagement that just perpetuates itself. And so you always, you know, every time you say the wrong word or you think you've done something not quite right, then a whole kind of inner kind of self-disparaging habit will take place. And we can, you know, we beat ourselves up sometimes. We're very cruel to ourselves because of that. So the awakening to that, then you're getting to the very the root of the problem rather than just trying to kind of, you know, just wipe it out or destroy it just through suppressing it or denying it. It's like the Buddha was saying, getting to the root is the thing, where you take the root out, then it won't grow again. But if you cut the weed off and the roots are still there, it'll grow in the same place. And it's just to find out, you know, you have just to be able to test yourself out in various ways. I found this quite challenging. In a monastic life, where in a life that I live, in the way I am, just using my character, my habits, my weaknesses for reflection. And learning from them, so that you're always learning, because in a lifetime, you know, it's a process. It's a lifetime of understanding things, because we have to live through the lifetime of this form, through the body. So, like now, old age is learning a lot from the perception of getting old, you know, and. The results of having been a monk for 37 years, or for, you know, practicing meditation, or for living in a community with the monks and nuns for a long time, living in England for so long, and this, so you have the karma ripens, and so things suddenly something will appear in consciousness that can be quite surprising for me. But now there's a confidence, and you know, there's a confidence I have in learning how to use that situation. Like I find, you know, like in monasteries, the monks and nuns, we're kind of what you call harmony whingers. We always want harmony. And so, why can't we be harmonious? So you're working at quite, you know, people are quite committed to monastic life, so there's a lot of good things, a lot of good intention in it. And then you idealize it, you know, monks and nuns should be like this, you know, we shouldn't be selfish, and we should, you know, do our, perform our duties properly. So you go, you know, you have a work meeting and not very many monks show up, and grumble, grumble, and so then you're challenged a lot on just you know, what you expect from others, you know, what my character tends to expect from the monks or the nuns, and you begin to see that what I expect is so high that then nobody's going to be able to live up to my expectations. So then, you know, some try, in fact. You know, some people will try desperately to do everything that they think I want done. And still, you know, that's still a sense of, oh, you know, they were 5 minutes late. So getting to the root of the problem is you know, seeing that the holding on to expectations of others is suffering, and even wanting harmony all the time, demanding that everybody be harmonious is an impossible demand. So you recognize that sometimes the conditions for harmony are here, and sometimes they're not. And the more you recognize that, then you're actually creating, you know, your attitude towards the situation, rather than perpetuating disharmony, you're not making a problem about it. So the sense of harmony increases. But if every time there's disharmony and I started, you know, getting upset and demanding harmony, then that would increase the disharmony, you know, just perpetuating the problem. So recognize, just learning to recognize those tendencies that you have without criticizing, but you know, wisdom. Basically, you know, when you open yourself, you're actually opening to a universal wisdom and intelligence. It's not which you as a personality might not recognize. Because on a personal level, we might see ourselves as, we have very fixed views about what we are, you know, as personalities. But basically, this wisdom can operate through these forms, through these human forms, if we kind of step out of the way, if we don't block the wisdom. So there's like this awareness is kind of opening the channel where wisdom can operate into an active form. And I can't claim wisdom on a personal level. You know, you're going to say I'm a very wise man and all that. I can't claim that as some kind of personal virtue. But I can see that wisdom is natural to us all if we open to life. You know, it's not a personal gift that one has more of than somebody else. But when you think of, you know, how much, you know, when the ego steps in, then I get very reactive. So, you know, I used to find, you know, being a leader, being put in a leadership position for so many years, being a teacher and all, an abbot of a monastery and all that, you're putting yourself always, you know, you're kind of stuck. I used to feel stuck in a position like a sitting duck must feel. You know, you just, you're up there and everything is aimed at you. So you, it's, you know, and it has its perks, you know, but it also, as a claimant, as a personal position, it's unbearable. And if I claim this position and I depend on it as my the way I relate to everything in life, it's an unbearable position, because you get very lonely if you're always this abbot at the top of the, you know, or the king on the throne, and you're just, you know, everybody, and your only relationship to everything else is from a particular position that's always above the rest. You know, it. You know, some people think that might be nice, but it isn't. You know, it's incredibly lonely. Nobody sees you as a human being or anything. You know, and then when your humanity might come forth, they feel disappointed, you know, that the Buddha Rupa, you know, they want you to be like made of marble or something. So at least that's the way I used to feel, you know. So by clinging to a role and then operating from that position, and clinging to it so it becomes a personal thing, I found it was a lot of suffering. Because just like being abbot of a monastery, you know, like building this monastery, I'm responsible. You know, when you start building the temple, and I found out how much it was going to cost, I nearly, you know, wanted to run away. Because I'm responsible for this thing. You know, you got this, I'm the abbot and I'm the one that decided to do this, and so you take on the responsibility, and then everybody, and if it fails, then everybody, you know, has a fortunately it succeeded, so I but then But then just reflecting on this in terms of you know, how I relate to the position, if I cling to it, it's suffering. If I don't cling to it, there's no, I don't create suffering around it. So just learning to recognize that, the difference between attachment or clinging and non-attachment, non-clinging. And that's a subtle internal thing that happens. You know, it's not like it manifests in any great form outside, but it's a very subtle, just to see how, you know, if I'm suffering from being the abbot of Amaravati, then I know I'm clinging to something here that I'm creating. So just by investigating that, you know, I said, find out what I'm attached to. Well, like if you've been brought up to take on responsibility, you know, like from my social background, you to work hard and be responsible, be independent. These kind of ideals very much was the programming of my life. So you're brought up to be independent, self-sufficient, be a responsible person, work hard, and you get rewarded for hard work. And so that's the kind of ideals of my ethnic background. So then that's inculcated in you when, you know, from the time you're born in some way or another, these are the messages you get. But then your personality forms around that. So I did succeed in, you know, moving myself into feeling self-sufficient, independent, and then taking on responsibilities, but also I began to fear responsibility. You know, like I would, because I would take it on such a personal level that if I couldn't be responsible to the ideal level that I imagined, then I'd suffer guilt, fear of betraying others, disappointing others, letting down the crew, and so you set yourself up, you know, to where after a while you just, you know, you can see why men become alcoholic, drug addicts. I can understand that. And so it's how one clings to that, how one attitude is towards those ideals. So then recognizing that, then because like in studying Buddhist teachings, then I could see that he was never kind of, you know, Buddhism has a lot of ideals, but they're clearly formed as ideals, you know, not to become attached to. So ideals are what they are in Buddhism, rather than something you should become. There's a difference there. An idea doesn't have flesh and blood, isn't a human being. Human beings are not ideals. Ideals are mental things. So you can imagine a perfect human being, but you'll never find one. So I warn you, don't go looking for one. But you can certainly imagine one, you know, perfect partner, perfect wife or husband, you can imagine, perfect mother and father, perfect abbot, you know. But you'll never find one, because an ideal, in seeing it in terms of Dhamma, an ideal is you know, you can create, and it's a mental thing, but it's not the way things are in terms of the flow of life that we experience. So then how do ideals relate to us? Should we just become cynical and say, don't attach to any ideals? You'll only get disappointed. That's what cynics do, isn't it? Cynics were usually very idealistic people that have been terribly disappointed by life. So you just say, well, there's not an honest human being on the planet, and, you know, everything's corrupt, and everybody has their price, You know, if you've got enough money, you can get anything you want from anybody, and you can become really bitter about the state of humanity. And that's because that's the reverse. But once you like, in terms of Dhamma, an ideal is what it is. It's not, if it's a beautiful ideal, it's beautiful. Beauty, a beautiful ideal is like this. So your relationship to it is recognition rather than identity or attachment. So if you compare yourself always with an ideal you have of what you should be, you're never going to be good enough. You're always going to be, you know, lacking in something, because an ideal is perfect. It doesn't, you know, the ideals I had when I was 20, but now at 70, they're still just as beautiful. So, but then the relationship changes to clinging and identity to recognition. It's like ideals point in a direction. They're like guiding stars. You know, they give you like nibbana and enlightenment. And this at first these are ideals. The ultimate truth, the realizing the ultimate truth. At first it's an ideal one is, and it gives you a direction. So you go, you move in like a guiding star, you move in that direction to keep going in the right direction. Then the realities of a particular time and place are like this. You know, so you've got to watch, you know, what's in front of you, you know, where your feet are, and where, you know, if there's a ditch or a wall or something. And if you're looking too high, you'll walk right into the wall and break your nose. So, you know, so you need that. So sati is the ability to embrace the whole, including the ideal and the existing conditions. Then that means that we can adapt, or, you know, the obstructions we have in life, you know, the challenges or the obstacles, the problems, the difficulties, then are put in a context of the path. You know, they're not, rather than seeing they're blocking everything off and I can't go because I can't get any further because of this, you know, you realize that life always challenges us in some way. So rather than, you know, a challenge then makes us, maybe the way that we react to a particular thing might be inadequate to this time and place. So then you say, well, maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way. And so you start, you know, developing a wisdom faculty and how to deal with it. Not have some fixed idea of if this obstacle arises, you do this and have it all figured out. But each situation is unique in its own right, in its own way. So you need this satipanya, or mindfulness wisdom, to trust in that. And by developing that, by learning to recognize that, then of course the obstructions, difficulties, problems, challenges come, but increasingly you find yourself more capable, more confident, not thrown off, not shattered by the experiences, by, say, unpleasant experiences that you might have been, you know, years before. So it's like maturing, these words, growing up and learning to trust yourself more too, because sometimes we don't, you know, we tend to, if you're critical towards yourself, you'll never develop much confidence in wisdom. You might assume, oh, I'm of no wisdom, you know, on a personal level, because maybe you don't feel like you're wise at all. But that's not the point. It's learning to recognize wisdom. And some people that feel they're very wise aren't. You know, it can be really foolish people can feel they're very wise. I mean, it's not a matter of convincing yourself, but recognizing, awakening to it.
Do you think it's just about taking this
Well, it's like to really kind of, what do you mean by that? You know, beginning to just recognize what you're expecting from that, from saying that. So, yeah. Like maybe your idea of being responsible is, you know, it can be a kind of tyrannical habit you have where you never, you have no way of reflecting or understanding. You're merely, because you can never maybe be as responsible as you think you should be, you'll end up thinking, I'm not responsible enough, or I've got to try harder, I've got to really be responsible for something. It can be another tyrannical attack on yourself. So responsibility is another guiding star. Don't grasp it, but you know it's beautiful. But it's also if it's grasped, then you'll fall into the ditch, maybe. Yeah. Well, the thing to do, I found, is just to trust in awareness of the, just you be aware of your body more, rather than try to find out, you know, you can imagine all kinds of things, but if you just allow yourself to trust in being aware of what's conscious right now, rather than,
yeah.
Well, then it'll come to you. The more you trust in your awareness, you'll see other options. You know, if you're struggling with it, then sometimes you bind yourself to either, you know, limited options. No, what?
It's just so boring. I mean, it's kind of like a personal, pretty mundane thing. Shall I say what it is?
If you.
That was something that I mentally, I didn't think, oh, they're coming, I'm not going to like this. It didn't happen like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just that's what happened. That's the way it is, you know. Because oftentimes in your things we develop these patterns when we're young, and you know, in early childhood, so they keep repeating themselves, and they're not intentional, or even, you know, you're not like you're intending anything, or, you know, it's not a choice you've made. But when this happens, I feel like this. This you can know. And so when, you know, when that particular, when those conditions arose, this is what you were feeling, you know. Well, that's, then be aware and just recognize this is the way it is. You know, not, that's not a kind of fatalistic resignation, but more or less a reflection that when this is, you know, it brought up this maybe sense of insecurity and then just to know that, just to be more aware of it, will help, you know, in the present. Then you can maybe, you know, as your life develops, you can figure a way to either get another place or what, change the situation if you can. But say if you can't possibly change the situation, you could actually find, you know, you could develop an awareness in which you could endure the conditions there. So, I mean, it's not that you should do that, but I mean, if that's the only option, it's still not an obstruction. Well, like in any situation, there's so many, you know, each situation has its own unique conditions affecting it. So that's where the immediate awareness, it's not a critical thing. It's not like saying that you shouldn't feel like this, or that, you know, you shouldn't react like this, because sometimes we don't want to react like that, and so we can be self-disparaging. But what is really honest and direct is, when this happens, this is what I feel, and to know that, and to let it be like that. So also you find, as you're more aware of your, like, you, that's another important point you brought up, is really bringing your body into the awareness. Because sometimes when I talk of awareness, it sounds too mental, but your physical body needs, you know, should, it's a point, it's something that we have for a lifetime. So it is important in terms of, it affects us all the time. So it's learning to embrace that, the physical body, not, you know, not go like this, but to include that, to be aware of how the body is in the present. So if you're feeling tension, or, you know, the stress is manifesting through your shoulders or your legs or whatever, then by bringing those, your attention to that, will help to, you know, will be good for the body, because the body takes, you know, holds things within it, and then so it you know, we get traumatized through life in various ways, physically or emotionally. So then the body can hold these traumas, and then we adjust our lives around that. So then people have all kinds of emotional problems and things around, you know, that they just don't understand why, you know, because, you know, they've just, you can readjust yourself to get used to tension in your shoulders, or to some kind of emotional block. You just learn how to live, you know, and not even know it exists. Except when the conditions for that arise again, and then suddenly you find yourself maybe falling apart over something rather trivial, and you don't know why. so this is where the, you know, the physical body is to be recognized, you know, so it's one of the objects of concentration. and a mindfulness. The Gayanupassana is the awareness of the physical body. And actually, the more awareness you generate towards your body, the more, then the body likes that. Now, this I know, my body does anyway. You know, if I live only in up here and then ignore the body, then it'll start, you know, I can, after a while it'll get very, it'll make incredible demands, you know, it'll start being painful and difficult and get sick and all kinds of things. You know, because the body is not being acknowledged, it's just being used. I'm just exploiting it. So they say in modern jargon, I'll head trip, live up my head, and then I'm just using the body to kind of support that. So we, you know, when you're young, you know, youth can really misuse their body. They can exploit them. Because you can get away with a lot when you're young. As you get older, you pay the price. It's not, you can feel it. You know, you can't do that. And so in your awareness, you know, really the like feeling the like pain in the body or tension in the body. You know, like being aware of that and letting it be the way it is. Not to just get rid of it, but to accept it. I find then the body quite likes that. It starts, it will, you know, development around awareness of physical feeling will really relax the body. The body will just, its tensions will drop. And oftentimes it's the tensions that create the pain. You know, if you have physical pain and you're trying to get rid of it, it makes it worse. Because to force to get rid of the pain, you're creating more tension. Yeah, well, it's, you know, I find, you know, people do very critical of themselves as the common, quite common in the Western world anyway. So, and a lot of guilt. We suffer a lot of guilt. And you don't find that so much in, you know, not to the degree in like in Asian countries, like the Tibetans or the Thais. They have shame and that, but then it's not, they don't tend to, you know, have this thing around you all the time of feeling guilty. And why are we, you know, why are we so neurotic? Because it's a kind of neurosis that we have, that we pick up, you know, through the society, the way it conditions us. And then my insight into it is just seeing how that when you're coming from a very idealistic society, you know, like say I'm from the States, so Americans were very idealistic, you know, about democracy and freedom and rights, and we come from these beautiful ideals, and then the result of that is because it's not a wise society. We get neurotic, you know. So we can never be good enough. So one just, you know, if you're comparing yourself with an ideal, you're going to be forced to always be critical of yourself. because it's not, you know, you're not an ideal. So you compare yourself with the marble Buddha Rupa, you know, and it's several hundred years old and still looks pretty good, a little beat up, but you're not going to look that good when you're 200 years old. So if you compare yourself with that, you know, you're going to feel definitely inferior, not as good. You can't, you know, but if the Buddha Rupa helps you to look at yourself, then you're using the ideal to remind you, and then you're skillfully using the ideal, not as a way of persecuting yourself, but as a way of reminding yourself. Yeah, this Buddha Rupa, it's from Burma, and I think somebody must have stolen it out of a Burmese temple. Some British person. And it's very heavy, actually, but when it was brought here, it was all beat up. You know, we had an antique restorer do a lot, like the aura around it, and it was all broken off. And then it looked like they put some kind of chains around it, and they pulled it so there was gouges in the side, and the nose had been broken off, and things like this. So, but yet you could see quite, even in its most beat up condition, is still an inspiring figure. So we found an antique restorer in London who took it on to kind of bring it back. Yeah. It's been abused. But you notice it's not neurotic about it. And it wasn't even complaining. You know. It isn't anti-British or anything. Yes? Yeah, well, I mean, that's the way things are. That's what I, you know, emphasize. It's not a kind of fatalistic resignation to misery, which it might sound like when I say that. You know, so but at this moment now, as you are right now, this is the way it is. You know, so whatever way you are right now, you know, physically, emotionally, or whatever, it's not you're resigned to it as being this is what I'm going to be like all the time, but it is the way it is. So it's in this way, this reflection of accepting the way it is doesn't mean like you just resign yourself if you're miserable to being miserable, but you're actually transcending the misery in the present by recognizing it. The saying, if you are, you know, if you're feeling terrible and whatnot, or you're in that, you know, where you live or the situation you're in is unbearable, it's not that you should resign yourself to that. But by recognizing the misery and the feeling and the condition as is, it gives you, instead of just resigning yourself to it and just being fatalistic or rebelling against it foolishly, it gives you perspective on how you're open to it. So your wisdom faculty will start offering. So then you begin to see ways of, you know, if it's an unbearable situation and it seems that way, then you'll find ways to improve it. You know, it doesn't discount that possibility. But say you're in a situation where there's nothing you can do, then it also, there's an acceptance of a misfortune that we can also wisely use, if that's all that if that's the only possibility. So like people with chronic pain or disabilities, or you know, you meet people who've been incarcerated in prisons or in prison camps and so forth, and where they have no options, and the ones that survive it usually can learn to bear with and accept what they're feeling, even though they don't like it, you know. But they're not dwelling on it with anger or resentment, or they're not denying it either. So it's finding this what one can call like a transcendent place or a being in which your awareness is operating full capacity, and in which the conditions that are generated into consciousness in the present can be recognized, and then the wisdom will start operating in ways of how to respond to that through action or speech or just patient forbearance or whatever. You'll find the best way to learn from that situation. Like people that have disabilities have to resign themselves to, if you're blind or something, then you know, if you always resent being blind, then you're making yourself miserable. Or you go around always trying to find a way so you can see, and nothing ever works. And so you're always, you're always hoping that you have an eye transplant or something like that. some miracle will happen, and then you can always be looking for the next possibility. Sometimes if one's blind and then there's no possible way, then to resign oneself to that means to accept it. And then we can deal with other things in life. We're not just reacting to this disability and then resenting the fact that other people see and I can't, or that nobody can cure it, or believing that my life is ruined because of it. So then you find, you know, some people that really understand Dhamma, oftentimes you find disabled people sometimes really get it very quickly. because they don't have that many options sometimes. No suffering, you know, whether you know, if life is too easy, you can't be bothered. I was talking to somebody yesterday about a mutual acquaintance in Australia, and I knew this person years ago, you know, like 25 years ago or so, and I've never heard from him since, but I hear now he was a monk for a while, and then he disrobed, and then and he's from a wealthy family, and he had, you know, so, but he never had any kind of never could commit himself to anything, or so everything was half-hearted, and he could just float by in a country like Australia, doing everything kind of half-heartedly. And so he's kind of now 50 and depressed. And you know, and it's a result of, you know, half-hearted life, and in a modern society, like here in Britain, you can live your life in this country without putting much effort into your life. The society will carry you, you know. You can just do nothing, really, and get by here. And so it's not like a society that demands all that much. But that has its good point. I'm not complaining, because it's, you know, I quite appreciate that. But also, the dark side of that is that one can never be forced to really using one's life for something, you know, to survive or to really get beyond some limitation, because you can just get by half-hearted, easy life, if that's what you tend to do. Whereas sometimes the real tribulations are where, I know the real difficult patches with me have been the most, I've learned the most, where life can really get difficult, really difficult, and really push you to the edge, and you have to survive, you have to rise to it, you know, or you're just going to be shattered, destroyed. So then when that has something in me comes forth, and because that's been good for me, because it gives me a confidence and a strength I wouldn't have if I just ridden along, things all right.
It's not in our teachings in this country to be actually encouraged to do that, it's to look at yourself though, is it? It's to be, you know, if you get depressed, you can take tablets, or, you know, if you get depressed, it's not really seen as perhaps a lesson play. It's seen as, you know, emotions, or they're not really to be looked at, they're pushed
to get rid of them, you know. That's the immediate reaction, is give me some antidepressants. I've got a pain, give me a painkiller, you know. So it's like wanting to get rid of, this is like, you know, always trying to get rid of something that you don't like is, you know, it's understandable. On the human level, that's understandable. Nobody wants pain or depression or things like this. These are, you know, we don't want these. And so that's a natural reaction. We want happiness. We want to feel good and feel healthy. And so that's natural, to want happiness and health and not want sickness and depression and pain. So that's not the problem. It's the ignorance and attachment, so that if, you know, if we don't awaken to life, then we're caught in these habits of always trying to run after happiness and run away from unhappiness. As soon as we get physical pain, to try to get rid of it as quickly as possible. Any stress, get rid of it as, you know, take a pill or get an injection or do something as quickly as you can. So you don't learn from that. You become addicted to things. But if you if you awaken, then happiness is, rather than your relationship to happiness and suffering is no longer just reacting to experience, but learning to recognize when happiness is present, when it's not. And when you're mindful, then happiness really is, it's a pure kind of happiness. But we can destroy our happiness by trying to cling to it. You know, so many people that are always seeking happiness, you know, to sustain happiness is an impossibility. So you always have to find the next thing that's going to make you happy, because the thing that makes you happy right now isn't, you can't, you know, it's not going to keep you happy. So you're going to have to look up for something else. So one gets, you know, in this, like a treadmill, always running, looking for more happiness, and then feeling increasingly depressed when you can't get it, you know, and you get bored and embittered. But the awareness of that, of happiness and suffering, is your refuge. So once, and that's what I mean when you awaken, you're actually awakening yourself to the nature of happiness is like this, unhappiness is like this. So you're not just caught in these natural reactions of holding on and or trying to push away. Then you find, you know, a balance. You know, you'll find you're actually aligning yourself with the universal reality. You know, you're no longer seeing yourself within the limitation of your personality or your human body and things like this that you tend to do if you're just caught in your habits. You know, so your habitual patterns are always based, I'm this physical body, I'm this person. And all the memories and emotional habits that you've acquired since you've been born, then you identify with that. And that's always binding you to keep repeating these things and identifying with them over and over again. And that's why it is depressing, because you know, and you know you can't keep youth and health and beauty and all these things, you can't, and when they, if that's depending on making you feel good, then when they start going, then you just get depressed and disappointed, disillusioned. So if this body was our true nature and what we are, then it, you know, it's pretty depressing to be a human being, because we're all going to die. I have a little card on my bulletin board in my kuti that says, cheer up. In a few years, we'll all be dead. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, that identity, it's, You're limiting yourself, and that's why one feels so you know, frustrated, because you're binding yourself always to limitation, and you, without intending to do it, you're not like you choose to do that. It's a habit. So in waking up, you then get perspective on habitual patterns that you don't have if you're just judging your habits, judging your habits from your personality, then you just get very critical and judgmental or justify or blame others or whatever the way that we tend to react to life, and none of those tendencies will be liberating. It's easy to blame my mother or my father, or blame the United States, or blame. You know, it's easy to look at your life and feel, you know, be critical of, you know, my parents should have been more like that and less like that, and you can definitely, you know, create a good critique of the United States of America, especially these days, and you can all just make out, you know, your unhappiness and your misery is because, you know, due to the faults of the experiences of life. But then one becomes a victim. You know, I'm just because I didn't get arahants for parents and wasn't born in a perfect country, then I'm a victim of life. You know, I should have had perfect, I should have been born in a perfect society with perfect parents and everything, with perfect school teachers, perfect everything. And then I would be perfect, and then I wouldn't suffer. You know, but I said before, that's... you can create that illusion, but that's not the way life is. Life is like this, you know, it feels like this. It's, you know, having a human body feels like this. And sometimes it feels good, sometimes it feels terrible. A lot of the time we don't even notice. You know, unless it goes, gets very sick or very, very pleasing, then emotionally, you know, like living in a community. You know, I could see one time years and years ago, I had this insight. You know how, you know, I was a bit being head of a community of monks and nuns. I was kind of feeling, you know, it's a bit threatening because they affect you so much. You know, so you feel, you know, how they're feeling. You feel it yourself. You're picking up on what they're thinking or feeling. And you're living with these people all the time. So you feel, in some ways, like it's a bit threatening situation to be the center of a community. And then to feel and be open to the kind of feelings that everyone in this community is having. And sometimes, you know, they see me, you know, as a cause of their suffering, or I get a lot of projections from them. And some of the things I might say or do might offend them and upset them in various ways. So I thought, this is a really scary position. I'd like to have been a hermit, you know, go off in a little hut in the mountains. That sounds very nice, because then I wouldn't have that wouldn't be there. So then, just being aware of that, how, you know, there was a kind of demand I was making on them. In a way, you know, quite unconscious, a demand that they get enlightened, that they act in a certain way, that they don't complain, that they get to things on time, that they live in live around me in a way that doesn't upset me or threaten me. And then when I really made that conscious, I saw I was asking for the impossible, you know. It was totally unfair demand. And yet it wasn't like intentionally demanding that. It's like it was just the habit, you know, because of this threat and this that comes from being the head of a community and then not wanting to deal with or feeling frustrated sometimes because I didn't quite know how to deal with their problems or how to relate to them. So it's in you know, it's a process of learning as you go along. And awareness is is the way that helps. Not just some nice idea, but the awareness and being more recognizing that I'm creating a problem out of them. What they're doing with me is their business. That's beyond my control. But I can create a problem out of you if I want, you know. So, and that's you know, that's my responsibility. Were you going to say that?
Yes. I was going to say, it's gone back to the responsibility.
Yeah. Right, yes, I agree. I mean, sometimes you can, you know, you can you know, bring them a glass of water if they're thirsty. In terms of emotional things, that most of us don't need advice. We need to learn how to accept it. And when others accept us, even if we're basket cases, then it makes it easier for us to accept ourselves. Yeah. So if somebody, a monk comes in and he's a basket case, and then I give him a sermon on, you shouldn't be like, then I'm only increasing the tendency for that monk to perpetuate that problem. So it's learning too, because this awareness is very kind, you know, it's compassionate, it's not judging, it's not even the most unpleasant things, it accepts, you know, it's not screening out and or giving grades to anyone. It's a compassionate ability we have to accept something for what it is. Doesn't mean we like it or want, but even what we don't like and don't want, we're accepting. Means we're allowing something to be, because at this moment this is the only way it can be at this moment. And if we trust that, then the changes that come out of that tend to, you know, come from a wisdom rather than just from guilt and shame and self-aversion and just being, trying to make yourself, you know, beat yourself up into always trying to take self-improvement courses and make yourself better and better and never quite succeed. Yes? I didn't quite understand.
If you're not good at it, if you're not meditating and trying to improve your understanding of yourself and others in life, what in the way is that? I mean, aren't we all muddling along like that? And what is there to actually, what is there to 100% do? I mean, they can help with others work in a hospital shop or whatever, but other than that, what?
Well, even Buddhist monks get depressed. So, well, I mean, this, life, you know, well, this is where the awareness, like depression, to me, is where you sink into some kind of negative state, and it seems hopeless. So you're stuck in this realm, and because, like, hope immediately snaps the depression, or some spark. Well, you know, because if there's hope in your life, then you don't tend to get depressed. But if there's no hope, it's a kind of despair. And just kind of sinking into this realm. So, and to get perspective, I can't speak with much authority on this because I've never been really depressed. So, like chronically depressed. So I mean, I can't really speak from experience about it. But in the way that I deal with negative mental states is, you know, is learning to trust in the awareness of them, because that puts me into a state of awakeness, so that the feeling of despair is then an object in the mind. It's not, I'm no longer attached and identified with it, but it's a, you're seeing that despair is a mental state, and that which is aware is not depressed. The awareness is never depressed. The emotional state can be depressed. So and in order to get that perspective, it's learning to trust in this imminent awakenness. And like with depression, that oftentimes if you're aware of just on a physical level of heaviness or just a mood of despair, and so just rather than trying to analyze it or figure it out, don't think about it, but more or less accept it for the way it is. So it's beginning to notice, awaken to this despair. It's like this. And in that, then you're actually, you know, you're abiding in a state of awakeness rather than in the lost or sunken to the despair. But if people are really depressed, it's very difficult to do, because like despair is like a total commitment. And then, you know, the improvement is, you know, it starts in little bits, like, you know, we'll just snap out of it, and then you can jolly them up a bit, but then they sink back into it. So it's not just, you know, it's learning to have it's learning to trust yourself more, like a person depressed is so kind of, probably hates themselves so much that he's a hopeless case, let's face it, and that's it. But if you're learning to trust in this awareness, means it's something you can really trust. And you can maybe only awaken in flashes or in that many moments, but it's learning to appreciate that, rather than thinking, once I awaken, I'm awakened all the time, forevermore. But there's moments, like flashes, or just moments where you recognize, and then you sink back into the emotion. But as you're more, as you begin to just really recognize that point, then you, more and more you move into that place of awareness. And then it's, because that's a natural state, it's not a created state. You know, it's not dependent on conditions being a certain way. You know, so it's not a fragile thing that everything has to be harmonious and peaceful around you for you to access it, but to recognize it's quite a natural state to be in. It sustains itself once you trust it. Then as you test it out more and more, you can prove it. You know, you can prove it to yourself. It's something that is to be seen and known for yourself. So it's not like a theory or an idea that you can't prove. It's just based on believing in something. But it's an awakened and recognizing, realizing. And at first, these awakened moments maybe just be very brief or even banal. They don't seem like much, but the more you recognize them, the more you incline to that. So, like in my own life, as a monk, I mean, the monastic life has it. You know, it's a kind of convention that supports this kind of practice very well. Because everything about it is for that. So but then how monks use the convention is another thing. So, I mean, it's, you know, even though it's meant for awareness, it can be used for the ego. You know, I want to become a famous monk, and I want to, you know, with a lot of power, I want to become the Pope of Western Europe, you know. And then I can, you know, become a, you know, an ambitious Buddhist monk, and all based on wanting power and being conceited. But, and then they say, look, Buddhist monks are all conceited and power-hungry fanatics. No, that's just him. he's kind of missed the boat, really. You know, it's like the monastic life, what is it for? You know, the idea of a bhikkhu or a monk, Buddhist monks, bhikkhu, is alms mendicant. You're kind of putting yourself in a totally vulnerable position. You know, so you're dependent on kindness of others, generosity. You know, so that's, you know, making myself dependent. If I could get power, you know, if I had, you know, if get power and wealth, and then I've got control, you know, and I might be able to do a lot of good things if I had lots of, you know, influence and, you know, help the poor and do that. But so it's you know, that can be very inspiring too. But then you're thinking, what did the Buddha have in mind when he established the monastic form? And you can see it's for the bhikkhu. It's not a thing, I'm a bhikkhu and I'm, you know, I'm somehow a superior being than you. You're only a lay person. Then I'm using it as a kind of social position, you know, kind of as a caste that I feel I'm better than you because I'm a monk. And that's a misuse. Because, you know, I need you. I'm dependent on you. And that's hard to say, isn't it? That's hard to say for a middle-class American. Well, I'm Ajahn Sumedho and I'm a meditation master, and you need me then. And then I can become very conceited. So I think I'll... That's enough for now, I think.